And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We start the Friday news review with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wederick. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
And we also have with us Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Welcome back, Sherry.
Happy New Year.
It's always nice to have both of you together. We wish Jay Hanselman, our City Hall reporter, could be with us as well. It's always fun when the three of you are in, but we want to wish him a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Jay.
Awesome. Big stuff out of the city this week, but let's start with this security deposit ordinance that P.G. Sittenfeld, Councilman Sittenfeld, was the chief proponent of. Chris, let's just start with an explainer of what it is.
So there are, folks who, a national statistic that they can't meet a $400 expense if they had it. And so Council Member Sittenfeld's idea was, well, how is anybody going to pay or how are many people going to pay a $900 or $1,000 security deposit for an apartment? Rents are tending to rise in Cincinnati. And so he wanted to look at other ways to kind of deal with that and make landlords secure, but also not take so much money out of tenants' pockets. So he had an ordinance passed this week that would give three different options. One, you could pay like a $3 monthly insurance fee to kind of cover that expense in case the landlord needed to, grab that security deposit from you. You could pay it in installments, or you could pay it over 6 months, or you could pay, you could require the security deposit to be spent or to be funded all at once, but it could only be 50% of the monthly rent. And so those are the three options that landlords now have in the city of Cincinnati. This was passed after several months of review and input from people. Originally, this insurance thing was going to take a bigger role, but it came up with three other options. It only applies to folks with 25 units or more, so they kind of view that as exempting mom-and-pop landlords.
And Sherry, that's key to point out, because I did see some reaction on social media from property owners who were really upset about this proposed legislation, but perhaps they were smaller property owners, maybe a couple of properties. This is really for people who have more than 25. Can you talk about the reaction to this legislation?
I think in general, like changing the status quo is pretty scary. And if you're a landlord, you have made a huge investment in the property and you're required to take care of it. And that does cost money. And so you do want to have that, security deposit in case things don't go well. And, just like everything, there's a few bad apples that kind of skew into, predatory always kind of taking that security deposit. But in general, that's kind of the theory behind it. And this scared, the status quo. And they were worried about it. And to P.G. Sittenfeld's credit, he proposed this. It's first of its kind legislation, which I think is important. The idea that you could get insurance for a security deposit was really the innovative part of this, but it ended up, being with these three options to really help these property owners make them, more comfortable with how this is. It'll be interesting to see. There's a tracking mechanism with it, and I'm interested to see how many times it actually is the insurance is used for it.
Right.
So if it is the first of its kind legislation, how did it come about? How did this legislation become crafted? Do we have the answer to that? Were there some studies? Was there some organization that got involved?
I think some people brought the idea to him, but I'm not completely sure, to be honest with you.
Okay, well, I guess that's fair. But this is good legislation for him politically, it sounds like, as we head into another election year. And that's important because people in your line of journalism work who are at City Hall will wonder and talk about who might be the mayoral candidates in 2021. And we can talk about Councilman Sittenfeld's prospects. But I think it's fair to say a pretty major potential candidate has decided not to run. And that is Vice Mayor Chris Smitherman. Chris, what was his reasoning?
Vice Mayor Smitherman's wife passed away just about a year ago, and that has obviously had a major, major impact on his family. And he released a statement earlier this week that said, basically, look, I need to continue to grieve with my family, and I need to continue that process. And, therefore, I'm bowing out at this point for future office. He did have the caveat that he's not retiring from public life. He still believes
he called it a pause.
A pause, yeah. I think we'll see him run again, you know, potentially in 2022 for county commissioner. I think that's one of the things being kind of chattered about in the political class in Cincinnati. But at this point, he's going to, bow out of that mayor's race, which was kind of a highly anticipated race between him and Councilman Sittenfeld, because there is a lot of animosity between the two of them.
That's been the narrative for many, many months, maybe even a year now, about who would be squaring off for mayor next year, and that it would be these two members of city council. I will note, when Chris Smitherman, the vice mayor, posted to Twitter his announcement that he was not going to run, you could see his own sons responding about, how proud they are of him, of the decision that he's made. So that you can tell that the family's been through a lot, and they've had to be there for each other after losing Pamela Smitherman to cancer.
This was a difficult decision. I wrote a story about Pamela before she died, and I had an opportunity to spend a lot of time with her. And at that time in their life, this was the trajectory that Christopher was on. He put all this time in. He'd done various things throughout his career, and he was just on the trajectory to want to be mayor. And she really supported that. But things change, and he talked about it. And later he said to me after posting the statement, and this was, it just really has resonated with me all week, honestly. Sometimes you can't have it all. And that's a hard thing when you're a type A person and you've done so much like he has in his career. And it's like, and he just realized that he had to put his family first. For him to win mayor, he knows it. Everybody knows it. It was going to start now, and it was going to be every day. And if you try and get on P.G. Sittenfeld's schedule, it is a constant stream of meetings. And they are about City Hall business now, but they are also about that mayor's race. And it was going to start now, and that does mean you are away from your family. This is a city of 300,000 people. It's small, but it's large. And so I think he saw that it just wasn't going to be the time.
So where does this leave the mayor's race, do we think? If we can speculate or maybe share some of the speculation.
Happy to. Councilmember Sittenfeld's obviously the front runner, and he was probably the front runner, going back several years at this point. I mean, we haven't seen an official announcement from him, but of course, this is what is going to happen. He's going to run for this race or for this office, and he's been preparing to do so. He's been raising bucket loads of money. But an open mayor's race is something that it is hard for a politician to pass up if they have that ambition. And it's hard for me to believe that he would go unopposed to that. There's a number of Democrats that have been talked about. I have to say, though, that many of them were talked about in the context of, is P.G. Sittenfeld stumbling against the vice mayor? Is he going to be able to do this? And so the names that we've kind of heard, former Mayor Mark Mallory, State Senator Eric Kearney, Representative Alicia Reese, who's running for county commission right now, and even potentially Councilman David Mann, those are all names that have kind of been out there, and people, who have either talked to others about it or are continuing to weigh their options. They will all start at a deficit to Councilmember Sittenfeld in terms of money raised, infrastructure built, in terms of the politics of this. So it's still possible someone could run. And then you have the Republican side. This is an interesting situation for them because Vice Mayor Smitherman, while an independent, he was kind of viewed as a palatable candidate for Republicans. He spent a lot of time on conservative talk radio over the years trying to kind of build that base. And so they definitely viewed him as the guy that they were going to back in 2021. Now they're kind of left without a standard bearer. None of the Democrats that I just mentioned are kind of in the tradition of John Cranley or Charlie Lukin, Democrats who Republicans, particularly on the West Side, kind of found acceptable. So they're kind of without a home at this point, and it'll be interesting to see if the Republicans can come up with anybody to take.
Alex Triantafilou, the Republican Party chair here, he did tweet that they are going to, really work to get a candidate, which suggests they don't have one, and it's almost impossible for a Republican to win. But what Chris is really getting at is this more moderate Democrat, and that line seems pretty short.
There's not a natural successor really to John Cranley in that respect, in the way that he and the Lukin family have kind of carved out that niche in the Democratic Party where there's a lot of crossover conservative or moderate or leading Republicans.
And we saw that play out in the previous mayor's race with John Cranley running against Councilwoman Yvette Simpson, who maybe represented.
As long as we're throwing out names now, come on.
Sure.
I've heard that name this week.
Yvette Simpson possibly mm-hmm. coming back and running.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people who would like to see her make a comeback.
She's built quite a brand for herself now as a national political commentator with frequent appearances on NPR and ABC News. So you have to wonder if maybe she's enjoying that a little bit now.
The thing to remember about this, though, is that she is friends with Councilmember Sittenfeld. And months, probably more than a year ago, she told me, I'm supporting PG. And that was a long time ago, and things change, and people think of new, you know, you're right. She has evolved as a political figure in this town since then. So maybe she gives it a look.
Well,
I'll say one more thing about
sure.
it. This is going to be a change moment in our city. PG is the front runner, but the idea that there is an absolutely open seat with no heir apparent in a field race is a very big deal. Plus, we have six council seats that are going to be open. It is a change moment.
I'm reminded of when Mark Mallory ran for re-election, and there wasn't really a likely contender to take him on, and it was really the first time we were all introduced to Brad Winstrup, right? And he came so much closer than anyone thought to beating Mark Mallory. So it is possible that you can come out of nowhere and be competitive. And of course, now he's Congressman Brad Winstrup. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that a late dark horse could emerge. We should also note that the mayoral race is 2021. We have elections this year.
All the things I thought we would be talking about in January, this isn't it, but here we are.
Well, we didn't expect that. We can never predict the news cycle, but we're always excited to talk about it. And so I guess the outcomes of some of these 2020 primaries or November elections could end up shaping people's own positions on themselves as candidates for mayor. So we'll have to wait and see. But while we're on the topic of this year's endorsements, the Hamilton County Democratic Party Executive Committee is meeting on Saturday. There are some potential endorsements that could come out in competitive primaries. Chris, what's at stake on Saturday?
I think you want to look for two races to be, you know, to potentially have endorsements. One is the sheriff's race between the incumbent Sheriff Jim Neal and his challenger, Charmaine McGuffey. We're hearing that maybe Charmaine has rounded up the votes for that at this point. We will see on Saturday, but that would be kind of a major political earthquake if the incumbent sheriff is not endorsed for re-election. Well, really, it would be an earthquake if the challenger is endorsed over the incumbent. There's probably some people in the party who are like, we need to stay out of these things. This is just going to engender bad feelings. But, you know, the Democratic Party endorsement has proven lately to be a very, very good way to win a race.
Does it help with money into the campaign?
Absolutely. Yeah. Right.
It's more about the sample ballot.
It's sample ballot.
You know,
ballot,
people who don't necessarily pay attention, like Chris and I would want them to read every single thing that we write. You know, push comes to shove, if you know, some people, they want to vote their slate and they just pick up the card on the way into the polling. This card matters. These endorsements, they really do.
Is it typical that the Central Committee would endorse a competitive in a competitive primary?
This has been asked a lot, and I have to say, we haven't had that. I can't really think of a major contested Democratic Party race that we've had where this was an issue as much. And we have three or four right now. You know, the other ones are the county commission race between Alicia Reese and Connie Pillich, and the prosecutor's race between Gabe Davis and Fanon Rucker. So, you know, you have these three major races for big offices, and you have Democrats fighting to get on the ballot. This is a sea change in our politics from the last really 50 years in
the
terms
toughest
of Democratic competitiveness.
I think that I'm with you on the idea that Charmaine has probably rounded up the votes to get this endorsement, which I agree that's pretty big news. I'm really interested. What I want to see is if they really take the commitment to endorse Connie over Alicia. There's a lot of mm-hmm. divide in the party. This is a very hard decision to make. And we just honestly saw them really not make a big decision, because they could have chosen either one of those, you know, very qualified candidates to replace Todd Portoon. But instead, they went with his wishes for Victoria Parks, who's very much in line with his ideals and is a good candidate, but isn't the final candidate. And typically, you would see, you know, the party be like, well, let's give our person a leg up. And we've actually seen people resign early just so they can have an appointment. But in that case, they made not the hard decision. They let it kind of slip through for the rest of the year. So I'll be interested to see if they did that, but then they the very next week, that was last week, they're going to endorse.
I feel like in that case, they felt it would dishonor Todd Portoon to not choose his preferred person to at least fill out his term. To me, by the time that vote was held, there was just no question it was going to happen. And I think there were behind the scenes and in deep, if you, you know, ask them deep down, you know, Connie Alicia would probably say, oh, yeah, I would have preferred to get that seat at that moment. But
no, everybody was just being very nice.
Everyone was very on their best behavior, which sometimes is hard.
Honestly,
for Democrats.
I kind of support that.
But it does mean we have to work on Saturday in some respects. Some reporters will be there.
Second,
follow Scott Wharton. They never.
And Howard Wilkinson from WVXU will be there. And Chris, I imagine you'll be there as well. A former name associated with Cincinnati City Hall, Harry Black, the old city manager, is city manager again, just not here. What's the latest with him?
Well, Harry, you know, he's been interviewing for a number of jobs. You got to remember, this was a huge mess in 2018 with Mayor Cranley trying to dismiss him as city manager and city council resisting that for about 6 weeks before they kind of grabbed Greg Landsman's vote and were able to force him out. I think he'd been looking for a job. He'd been a finalist in some other cities, which escaped me at the moment. But he
Gainesville, Corpus Christi.
Yeah, it was in Florida, I remember.
All of these places are very warm, I notice. I don't think that's an accident. But he did get confirmed by the Stockton City Council, Stockton, California, which is in the central part of the state there. And
was described as one of the best city managers in the nation.
He was. That was how the mayor of Stockton described him. And he'll be making more than he did in Cincinnati. And Stockton's just a little bit bigger, but a smaller metro area overall. So I think people wish him the best.
We all cover government, and I've found that the position of city manager or city administrator, whatever it might be called, has got to be one of the worst jobs because, like, you have a lot of responsibility, right? You seldom get to take the credit, right? Because politicians want to do
it. A former county administrator, when they got the job, I was like, congratulations, said to me, oh, Sherry, the only place I have to go from here is to being fired.
It is like being the manager of a baseball team or the coach of a football team. You are hired to get fired later. And, you know, people are like, why do you, you know, they hate these severance packages that these people get when they're dismissed. But there's a reason for that.
I will offer one piece of commentary on Harry and why I found this is a stunning decision. This city in California fired their former city manager. And because he was not following the will of the council. Now, Harry, you know, he had his ultimate thing ended up being having to do with the 911 center and Kyle Plush. He was 2 seconds from being fired, you know, on a Saturday morning special meeting when he actually resigned. But it really came down to our council was not happy with the fact that he was not following their direction. And then the mayor wasn't happy with, you know, their relationship. And the idea that I feel like they just kind of overlooked. Those were the real issues here. And it was just the issue that they just had. There was a lot of glowing terms that came out of that meeting out there.
Yeah. I see it a little bit differently, but we can move on.
Okay.
Chris, you reported earlier in the week on the fate of the Millennium Hotel. And this has been an interesting story because it is like the largest hotel in downtown Cincinnati. Yeah. And it's about to be torn down. It looks like that's proceeding.
Probably, yes. So that's one of the first steps. Basically, the Port Authority Board voted to say, okay, when you get the money from the hotel tax that apparently will be needed to buy and tear this down, you can go ahead and sell the bonds that are needed to do that. And so this is step one. There's several other steps. We have a Convention Facilities Authority meeting later this month in which they will vote to provide that money, or at least take a vote. I'm not sure they'll vote to do it. I think that's where it's heading. But so that's step one of a couple more step process.
And while we were talking about the Hamilton County Commission, Sherry, I missed an opportunity to bring up that the new member of the County Commission hired a chief of staff. Can you tell us about it?
You know, we saw this last night. This was actually a stunning piece of news. Stephanie Dumas, you know, she her chief of staff left for some family reasons. And so she had, you know, a new choice to make.
And I guess she's not the newest member of the commission anymore, right?
True. Bishop Bobby Hilton was her choice. And Bishop Bobby Hilton is a respected member of, you know, our pastoral community, very definitely like propelled into the narrative with his support of Tracy Hunter. Very, very popular figure, but not somebody you were like, oh, he's on the path to be a chief of staff. And so that was a stunning announcement last night.
So many moving parts. This is the first time I've seen you all in 2020. I got to ask, any New Year's resolutions? I'll take that as a no.
I just setting yourself up for failure.
Come on. Sherry, I know you're a fan of resolutions.
I think that Alex Coolidge, my husband, might be listening. He knows I'm on today. And so he wants me to say that I am on a financial, just being more like careful and mindful. And so that is Sherry Coolidge.
All right. Fiscal conservatism.
Alex Coolidge, also a very talented Inquirer reporter that we like having on as well. Sherry Coolidge from the Inquirer, Chris Wederick from the Business Courier. Thanks to both of you for coming in today. Appreciate it always.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So why is it so hard to drive on Ohio roads in the rain? We've got that story just ahead. And could Cincinnati be home to a minor league National Basketball Association team? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the Friday news review now with Inquirer columnist Jason Williams. Welcome back, Jason. It's been a while.
Hey, yeah, it has been. Thanks, Michael. I appreciate you having me on. And I know it's, what, January 16th, but I haven't seen you, so Happy New Year.
I appreciate that. Same
when is too late? When's it too late?
I think you have the whole month. I think Okay. Once you get to February, it gets a little awkward. So yes. I will take it all through January. So Happy New Year to you. I hope it's a great year for you. I certainly enjoy your opinion columns, not just because they're well-written and well-thought out, but because it's always fun to read comments on Twitter. I don't want to disparage you by calling you an instigator, but certainly it instigates a conversation.
Well, I believe to... You know, to be a columnist, it's your job to take a stand on issues and on this political stuff as a political columnist. And my focus is on really holding public officials accountable, whether they're Democrat or Republican or neither. And that sometimes that wins me a lot of comments from both sides oftentimes.
And you got a comment this week that we want to talk about from Chris Seelbach, the city councilman here in Cincinnati, who took exception to a column that you wrote where it appears, if I could characterize it, that you're writing that the council is maybe wasting its time a little bit on some issues that aren't important. First, tell us what some of those issues in your mind are.
Some of the things are wasting time. Well, I think the biggest thing was... It just didn't set a good tone when Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman, in the very first meeting of the new year, the committee meeting, the Law and Public Safety meeting, comes out and spends a majority of that meeting on the text messages. The so-called Gang of Five text message scandal has moved really away from City Hall. There's currently a special prosecutor looking into that issue right now at the request of the state auditor. And so that's in the hands of that special prosecutor. But at some point, City Hall has to get back to business. And for him to spend – he had two of his three agenda items were regarding the Gang of Five text messages. For him to come right out of the gate and spend that kind of time on that issue was like, ooh, this is not a good sign.
And so I wonder then, because we just had in our previous segment a pretty good discussion about Chris Smitherman deciding not to run for mayor, as he had been anticipated to do. You would think from him going on the attack on the so-called Gang of Five, because that includes P.G. Sittenfeld, another likely candidate for mayor, that he was positioning himself for the election year. So were you surprised when he withdrew?
The timing of it, certainly. I'm not surprised, ultimately, that he withdrew. I think there had been some buzz in recent weeks that he was not going to end up running, certainly with taking care of his family, most importantly. And I have great respect for him for doing that. And then there was also questions about whether he could even be mayor he could be mayor if he were elected. But his brother... Albert Smitherman owns a very successful construction company that does a lot of business with the city, and whether that was going to be even possible to continue, that relationship, something would have had to give because of the conflict of interest. You know, Christopher Smitherman has been very good about recusing himself from anything that's come before a council, but you can't recuse yourself as mayor. You control the agenda. You're involved in all these development deals, and so that gets a little sticky there. So I think that no one's said anything, but I wonder if that ultimately also played into this.
You also note in your column about some of councilmen's strange some of the council's strange priorities. Yeah. In your view, City Councilman Chris Seelbach's very brief effort to remove a statue. Tell us about that.
There's a statue in Eden Park that, there was debate on whether I think the original thought was that it was given by Mussolini and It ultimately, I think, was the recommendation was from him, but it ultimately wasn't given from him. And my thing with that is just, again, it sets the tone for the year. Yeah, Councilman Jeff Pastor focusing on rename a street, a statue. Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with wanting to do those things. It's just right out of the gate. It sets a tone to me that these are bigger priorities to you as an individual council member than some of these other important things like, you know, affordable housing and getting back to some of the critical, you know, the city's really kind of gotten away from, they were really paving roads really well for a while, but then they've gotten away from a lot of these basic things. There's a lot of problems and or a lot of questions anyway with some things that are happening in the police department. You know, to me, it's like, come out of the gate, you know, focus on that stuff a little later on. I get it, but I don't know. It just didn't sit well, especially coming off just a tumultuous year for council.
You were tweeted at by Chris Silbach, the city councilman. He wants, let me quote him, "I want Inquirer and Jason Williams to do better because people want the truth." And then he says, he just offers some examples of what he looks at as priorities, like 15 new tax increment finance districts, and it questions whether, you know, are you, Jason, the columnist, not paying attention to what they view as accomplishments rather than what you are viewing on the other side of the agenda as petty issues?
Well, I think that I am very much paying attention. And I think that that is I think it sort of proves my point in that, you know, you're spending time on tweeting at me and writing op-eds about me. And it's like, it's not about me. It's about you doing what's right for the city of Cincinnati residents. You were elected to be there, and I'm not the beat writer. I can write opinion about whatever's going on there, and this is how I saw, and this is what I felt like this needed to be called out.
You're a sports guy also. You've got your Cincinnati Bearcats cap on today, and I see you tweet about football. You're Marshall? Is it Marshall?
I'm a UC grad, but I grew up in Southeast Ohio, so... Big Marshall football.
I see some tweets from you about Marshall, so yeah. I thought you might be a Marshall fan as well. So I see that you are a sports guy. And you had a great column this week about whether an NBA G League team could work in Cincinnati, and that there are some business interests that seem to think that that's possible. I think for our listeners' benefit, and certainly for mine, that I learned from your column, what's the NBA G League?
It's essentially the minor league affiliate of the NBA. They started this back in 2001. It was originally called the D League Development League.
Ah, see, I knew of the D League. I didn't realize that it was the same thing.
And a few years ago, Gatorade became the title sponsor of the league, so they renamed it the G League.
Of course.
And so it is really, it's the AAA of NBA basketball. There really isn't a minor league in America. There's some smaller leagues, but the NBA didn't have its own official affiliate. And so for, 17, 18 years here, they've now had this what's called the G League now. And there's one team left that essentially doesn't have its own affiliate, and that's the Denver Nuggets. And there's a group of folks that went through the Chamber Sea Change program, which is mid-career professionals who work on a major civic project. And they said, let's try to bring this here. One of the guys in, it's Nick Schroth, who also actually happens to work for the Chamber. But he spent 5 years working for the Washington Wizards in the NBA in their ticket office. And so he said, let's push this. And now they're in the mode to try to get some seed money to get in front of the NBA and present this and, you know, get some money to try to pay the rent on the arena wherever they end up playing.
So they don't have do they have a targeted arena, one of the many arenas?
Right out of the gate, their targeted arena is the University of Cincinnati. And then let's see what happens separately about the downtown arena. The Cincinnati Business Committee currently is commissioned a study looking at what to do about the downtown arena situation. So let's see what comes of that. I'm skeptical a bit. I'm skeptical of whether anything comes of that, but that's a different story.
Yeah. You have written about that, what we know as the Coliseum or U.S. Bank Arena and now the Heritage Bank Center.
Yep.
You've been pretty critical of that.
I just think it's you know, if you look around at our peer cities or the cities we like to compare ourselves to, Charlotte and Columbus and Indy and Nashville and Cleveland, these are all cities that have modern arenas. But the difference between them and us is that they have major anchor attendants to fill the dates. All those cities have NHL and or NBA teams. We don't have that. We're never going to get that. And so now the question is, how do you pay for this? Who's going to you know, fill the dates to pay the rent, certainly the Cyclones. And I think that's why this G League idea is intriguing, because if this can get stick here long term, you know, you start to just cobble together tenants that can help ultimately pay the bills. And maybe you can build a new arena. I think the model, and we can talk about this later, you know, we'll write about it later, but I think the model Cincinnati has to look to is Kansas City. They don't have an anchor tenant, but they've got a thriving downtown arena, the Sprint Center, which they built in 2007. Beautiful 19,000-seat place that's become just a real Midwestern mecca for major events. And
it's so strange that on so many different issues, Cincinnati is told to look at Kansas City.
I know. You know, it's interesting because it's on the streetcar, too. Street, that's car, right. They have a streetcar that runs well, and it is sounds like, by all accounts, is successful. And yeah, and I think because they have some of the things that we either that we want or we have and aren't or isn't working, and it's a very similar size market to us. So a place that we also compete with for jobs, you know, sort of that second tier, I don't know, middle tier city next to the
mid-major city, maybe.
Mid-major.
Yeah. And so we'll see if the Queen City Royals come to town. I guess that's the name that's been floated around as a potential G League team. Jason Williams, your podcast at the Inquirer, it's That's So Cincinnati or just So Cincinnati?
That's So Cincinnati.
That's So Cincinnati. Yes. You can listen to Jason opine or you can read his columns at the Inquirer. Jason Williams from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks so much for coming in and chatting. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael. Good to see you. Thanks.
Okay. So we will talk a little bit more about sports coming up, if you can imagine. We've got a couple of sports anchors who will be joining us to talk about Joe Burrow, the LSU quarterback who led that team to an undefeated national championship, and he may be coming to Cincinnati in the orange and the black. We're also going to tell you about why Ohio roads are so difficult to navigate in the rain, and we've got this huge new hangar opening at CVG Airport and a report on Cincinnati's Asian community, which is growing. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The Friday News Review continues now with the WVXU News team. A little news meeting going on here. We've got reporters from in-house. Ambriel Crutchfield, welcome back, Ambriel.
Hey.
Ann Thompson is with us. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Michael.
And Tana Weingartner. Hi, Tana.
Hi.
Let's start with you, Tana, because you had a story that went gangbusters online this week and was also a joy to listen to.
You're a joy to listen to, Michael.
Oh, I like how friendly we are at the top of each segment that we have you, and you're so nice to me. Thank you. This story was very interesting. This is about why Ohio roads can be so difficult to navigate.
And Kentucky and Indiana, yeah. Well, it's an all-over problem.
Okay, well, tell us why it's so hard to drive around here when it's wet.
Well, okay, so I was driving. I thought, oh my gosh, I can't see the lines. What's happened? Has something changed or whatever? And then I went online and I saw other people were also saying, you know, why are lines so hard to see when it rains? So I started Googling around and looking into the research and making phone calls. It turns out the largest technology that's used are these little glass beads that are either in the line paint or just coated on top. And when rain sits on top of them, you know, science happens and the light is from your headlamps isn't sent back to your eyes. It gets refracted in other directions, making the lines practically impossible to see.
Oh my gosh,
yeah.
This is so much more
so
complicated.
So it's not just you, yeah.
All right, so what did you find in terms of any potential remedies?
Well, the companies that make these things, like 3M and Innisfilt and folks like that, do have some alternatives. There are different technologies. There's different kinds of beads that will refract the light properly, even if there's water covering them. There are ways to raise the reflective materials up so the water doesn't cover them or pushes it away. There's lots of different types of things. But up until recently, people either haven't wanted to invest in them, you know, like ODOTs and KYTCs and things like that, because they're a little more expensive and they're the unknown. And there hasn't, you know, road transportation is just a slow-moving industry.
Well, can you share with us, I guess, how big of a concern this was? I know you were anecdotally sharing that you had a problem with
right.
that, and then you heard from others, but...
Yeah, a lot of people are pointing it out, especially in construction zones, which does get into a kind of a different set of technology because they use temporary lane markings in construction zones a lot of times. But, you know, they've laid them down and taken them up so many times that they're... There might be seven potential lines that you're looking at. You can't see any of them in the rain. But it's also becoming a really forefront issue for transportation companies like 3M and Innisfilt because of something that our Ann Thompson has reported on a lot, autonomous vehicles.
Oh.
Because they use cameras to see the lines and to sense. And if they can't see the line, you know, if you can't see the lines, the cameras can't see them either. So what I heard from Innes Flint was that they think this will be, you know, a more emerging area that people will start taking more interest in because of the rise of autonomous vehicles.
The future is terrifying. It's just terrifying. Even in little mundane ways you don't think about, the future is just absolutely terrifying. But the future is bright at CVG Airport and that surrounding area, and that's where we sent Ann Thompson.
I like that transition, Michael.
I'm getting better and better at transitions, if I may brag a little bit. I don't know how to transition to your story, Amory. I'll have to be careful with that. But tell me, what is the newest thing out at CVG this week?
The newest thing is this huge hangar that will service cargo planes. Apparently, if they needed any kind of major repair, they were sent away. And so with Cincinnati emerging as this epicenter of cargo, we needed something like this. And the thing that really amazes me is this might be the first of many, according to CVG CEO Candace McGraw.
She said that. This is an area that has seen so much development in recent years. After several years back where the narrative was pretty negative about the airport, it's just one thing after another out there in terms of the announcements and the development that's happening. What did this seem like while you were there? Was there a big promise of jobs?
Well, yes. So FEAM, the company that owns and will operate it, and that CEO, by the way, is a very colorful character. Fred Murphy had on a plaid suit. So he has already hired 200 people, and he plans to hire another 100. And somebody at the airport said these are high-paying jobs for mechanics, like between $60,000 to $70,000 to start. And then the client of FEAM's, which is I'll have to come back to that. Atlas Air. I always forget that name. So Atlas Air, they supply the planes to many of the, like DHL and Amazon. So they're the ones that got FEAM to come here. And they said that they plan to hire 600 more people in Northern Kentucky. They recently opened like a new facility in Erlanger. So, yes, there are a lot of jobs. And just to give you a sense of how big this hangar
that's
is.
That's what I wanted to ask.
So we were in a corner, we reporters and dozens of officials, and we were just in a very small corner. This hangar can hold a 747-400 and larger, the 800 series, or a number of different planes. And a retired state aviation commissioner, Steve Parker, he served as the MC, and he said, this is a really big deal. And he was telling the folks, you know, aviation is rocking in Kentucky.
Wow. You know, it'd be nice to be able to stand in that empty and just shout into the void just to let it all out. Wouldn't that be like an appropriate
room? I
thought
that might make a scene.
Amory Crutchfield, you had a great story this week about Cincinnati's growing Asian American community and how they want politicians' attention. First, what was the catalyst for this story?
Yeah, I just thought, so we hear so much about all these issues that are up for debate when we're talking local politics or national. And we hear about different voter blocks, whether it's the suburban white women that are we're talking about or the black women voter block, et cetera. So I was kind of like, I feel like we don't hear a lot of policies that are directed to Asian Americans. Like, for example, we hear immigration and normally Latinx community is targeted, or reparations, or black maternity rate. And so I'm like, if I'm hearing this way and I'm just listening to the news on different levels, how do the Asian American community feel? So I reached out to Felicity Tao and her family and just wanted to get a sense of what are the issues they care about and also how do they feel about being reached out to and what ways they feel like they're being targeted.
What did you find for issues that they were concerned about?
Yeah, so it kind of varied. I spoke to the mom, dad, and two sons. And so it was public education, the economy. It was also gun control and the Citizens United Act. So it kind of varied. And I also spoke to a University of Maryland Asian American Studies professor who articulated that sometimes politicians make continue stereotypes by saying, oh, Asians care about immigration or they care about education. And they try to double down on that. But they're interested in, of course, a range of issues.
And one of the folks you interviewed offered a suggestion on what politicians could maybe do to be more sensitive to their issues.
Yeah. So she said one issue that she hears a lot of people talking about is affirmative action. And so rather than taking a stance on the issue, maybe just educating themselves on what the issue is, how does that pertain to the community and their history connect to that, and then be open to hearing what people have to say and going forward that way. And it is important to note that this family is independent and they lean left, which is a big trend nationally for Asian Americans. So that's why I did the story as well, to highlight, like, this is a community that's kind of quote unquote up for grabs, and that you shouldn't just look past them and mention them as a footnote.
And you can read that story at WVXU.org along with the stories from Ann Thompson and Tana Weingartner. Do we have no animal news this week?
Oh, we have animal news.
Oh, go on.
It's zoo babies. We had sad news last week. This week we have zoo babies. We've got two penguin chicks that need names. They're food related names, preferably, so you can let the zoo know what you think. And a baby okapi born on my best friend's birthday on Monday is a boy. So he needs a name, too.
And that's the Tanimal Report. You can find out more on Tana's Twitter page, no doubt, and see what she's retweeting. Tana Weingartner, Embryo Crutchfield, and Thompson, thanks so much for all three of you coming in and chatting with us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Okay, we turn back to sports now. And joining me on the phone, our sports radio host, Andy Furman. Welcome back, Andy.
How are you, Mr. Monks? Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too. It's always great to talk to you. And I'm also grateful that we're joined on the phone by Fox 19 sports anchor Jeremy Rau. Jeremy,
He's
thank you
greatest.
For coming back on as well.
He's the greatest.
Hey, my absolute pleasure. And to be on with Andy, a legend, it's fantastic.
He's the greatest. I can't wait for tonight on Fox 19 now. I can't wait.
My guy.
I can feel the love on the line already. And I needed two of you because there's a lot of sports news that's happening in this town now. And the biggest, I believe, is this speculation, ongoing speculation about a guy named Joe Burrow. And I want to start with you, Jeremy, so that we can build up to how loud Andy is. So let's start with you. And just give us an idea of how excited people are to have LSU quarterback Joe Burrow, who led the Tigers to an undefeated season and a national championship, to suit up in the orange and black for the Bengals.
Well, I think the excitement is obviously palpable because you look at what Joe Burrow did, and it's not just, you know, the hype around the Bengals. It's what he did in the college football season, the one season where he just lit up college football and is arguably one of the greatest college football seasons we've ever seen from a quarterback. I know we're kind of recency biased, but to look at what he did, the records he set, the 60 passing touchdowns, which is a new single-season FBS record, I think all the excitement is there because of that, and also because he might be I would say one of the highest rated quarterbacks coming out of college into the draft since Andrew Luck. And I know that's a big statement because Andrew Luck was really highly touted, but Joe Burrow brings so much excitement and so much buzz, and that it's still presumed that he's going to be the number one pick to the Bengals. His dad's now kind of talking about it on some radio interviews about, you know, if he does go to Cincinnati, I think Joe would be happy to go there. And so, you know, you can kind of feel momentum gaining on that. I've had a chance to talk to a couple of sources around the Bengals who have not hidden the fact that they love Joe Burrow and are pretty much all in on him. So everything sets up like it's going to be Joe Burrow's name called at number one on April 23rd in Las Vegas by the Bengals. And obviously there's a lot of excitement around that.
And Andy, let me ask you, you've covered sports in Cincinnati for a long time. And can you compare this to another pending arrival of an athlete coming to town?
Well, I tell you what, Michael and Jeremy as well, I worry about this because I think the biggest story is not his stats and what he's accomplished. The biggest story is he says he doesn't like Skyline Chili. How in the hell is he going to make it in Cincinnati? How can you say that? Where are his handlers?
I mean, thought it was very brave.
It was, but it could be a death knell. It really could.
It made me comfortable coming out and saying I don't like Geta.
Well, I understand that, but the point is you're not Joe Burrow. You know, the kids are Michael Monk's like. Really, I hate to say that. You're big, but you're not that big.
That's fair. That's
really
fair.
But the point is this. I mean, at least say I haven't tried it yet. I don't have made a concerted effort to try it. That's bad. I mean, come on. Skyline Chili is like, it's ingrained in the city of Cincinnati. But would I like to see him here? I certainly would. Does he need help with him? Does he need an offensive line? Does he need some parts around him? He certainly does. But this is big. This is almost as big as when they drafted Kajana Carter. And God forbid if the same thing happens to him when Kajana hurt his knee and his leg, his ankle in Detroit at a preseason game. So let's hope he just stays healthy.
And Jeremy, what does it mean for the Bengals? Because it's not always that a star rookie quarterback takes the field and leads a team to the playoffs. What does it mean? Is Andy Dalton likely to go?
Yeah, it absolutely means that Andy Dalton is very likely to go. I think there's a small, tiny, tiny outside chance that Andy Dalton is able to stay and maybe groom Joe Burrow in some way or another. You know, we've seen, obviously, in New York with the Giants where Eli Manning, it's been like a revolving door where it's you know, Eli gets his shot, then they bring in Danny Jones, and Danny Jones will start, and then Eli gets to start at the end of the season. You know, that was kind of a mess. I don't expect it to play out like that. But I could see a scenario where Andy Dalton somehow is still around if no team sees him as a guy that they want or need in the offseason here, and is able to kind of groom Joe Burrow. But I would expect Joe Burrow to be the starter, I mean, for a large part of next season. I would expect him to be the starter for all of next season, but I could see an outside chance that, you know, there's a tiny chance that Andy Dalton sticks around. But Joe Burrow is meant to be the guy. I mean, you look at the way the NFL is now, and you know, Andy, you know this as well. It's rookie quarterbacks. I mean, these guys are drafted high, top five, top ten. They are meant to come in and start almost right away. It doesn't always happen that way. We didn't see with Dwayne Haskins with the Redskins last year. He didn't start the whole season, but that's kind of the new way of the NFL. Look at Kyler Murray with the Cardinals. And so if Joe Burrow does come in here, I don't know that it means that they go to the playoffs in year one, but doesn't mean they move that meter, get to something like 7-9, 8-8, and you see promise for the future. I think that would be the hope for the Bengals.
Andy, let me ask you, are we going to be disappointed for years to come with the Bengals, or is this possible addition of Joe Burrow going to change the culture of that organization?
I think the Joe Burrow addition, let's hope it happens, because it could be a trade down the road, but if it does happen, I think it's going to help mentally a lot of people right now, because it gives them hope. Right now, I think a lot of the fans have no hope. You watch those games, the last 3-4 home games. I mean, there were more people in Kroger than in the ballpark, really. It was embarrassing. It really is. I mean, they are the lowest club in attendance in the NFL the last 3 years. They need juice. They need a goose. And I think that Joe Burrow could get them on that right path. Let's hope he does. Again, but if they could get A.J. Green healthy, if A.J. Green could come back, get a good run game and some blocking up front, I think they could make a noise in that division. I really do.
All right, let's talk about college basketball. We are in basically the midway point, heading into March Madness, not too long out from now, and let's get an update on where the teams are. Obviously, I'm an unabashed fan of Northern Kentucky, especially since the transition to Division I, and everyone was very nervous when John Brannon left NKU to go to UC. And it looks like both teams are still figuring things out. Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, that is. Jeremy, can you give us an update on where both of those programs stand? NKU's hot right now, though.
I had a chance to watch NKU last night, Michael, against Youngstown State. Youngstown State came into the game 4-1 in conference play, a half game back of Wright State in the standings. And NKU just trounced Youngstown State, won by 25, and Dantez Walton, their best player, is still on the bench. I think he's going to come back sometime around February, early February. But last night was the first time that I saw NKU with my own eyes and thought, wow, Darren Horn is doing things. This is still another tournament kind of team. I mean, it would be a third time in 4 years if they can make the NCAA tournament. I understand that it's a one-bid league. You got to go win the conference tournament. But what I saw last night, understanding that Dantez Walton is going to come back, understanding that now the NKU is 5-2 in conference play and right behind Wright State, who they play next Friday on the road. I saw a lot of things that kind of reminded me that, hey, this program's still pretty darn good and still poised to make a run for the tournament again this year. As it pertains to UC and Xavier, I can't remember a time, and I've been here for just a little over 6 years now, I can't remember a time where we've been this far into the season and there has been this big of a question mark around both teams. I mean, both sides right now, there's no guarantee if either one is getting into the tournament. UC lost last night. They're now 3-2 in the American. And the American, if you're only going to win, I'm talking about season total, 20, 21 games, there is a very, very slim chance you're making the tournament. For Xavier, I think you can go 9-9 in the Big East and still make the tournament. But Xavier started out 1-4 in Big East play, so both of them right now have giant question marks about whether or not they can make the tournament if it comes down to an at-large bid.
Andy Furman, let's get your perspective on the season in our last 45 seconds.
Jeremy can help me with this, because I'm not that smart, as you know. I got like double-digit IQ. But here's the question I have. You know, with the problem with UC, everybody said they got to learn a new system. I didn't hear that question thrown out there with Darren Horn coming at the NKU, learning a new system. NKU just picked it up where they left off last year, and they trounced Youngstown State last night. They really did. And UC, the new system. It's only basketball. And what do I know? Look, I was an all-city basketball manager at Lafayette High School in Brooklyn, so I know a little bit about basketball. You throw the ball out, there's five guys playing five guys. It can't be that difficult. It's not neuroscience. I mean, come on. So the story at UC, there's something bigger going on at UC confidentially that I don't know, personality-wise. Jared Cumberland, I don't think there's a great relationship with the new coach. I don't know what's going on there, but believe me, it's more than just a system. Yeah. Is that right, Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean,
10 seconds.
You are right, Andy. Yeah, it's one of those things that the players have to buy in. I think it took too long, Andy, for the players to buy in with what John Brandon wanted to do, and now they're slowly starting to turn that corner.
Well, we'll continue to root. Andy Furman, sports radio host, and Fox 19 anchor, sports anchor Jeremy Rowell. Thanks to both of you for a great conversation. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Michael.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.